Yep. All right. So good morning, everybody. Everybody ready to learn about a cool tool? So first of all, who am I? My name is Paul Long, like Daryl said. I'm a technical evangelist in the Windows Interop group. And so one of the things I do is support this tool, Network Monitor. So how many people have used Network Monitor before? All right. And how many people use Wireshark? Okay. Similar programs that do some of the same things. Hopefully I'll let you know what you can do with Network Monitor that probably is beyond what Wireshark can do, at least as far as parsing goes. Also, previously I was in CPR, which is support group, handling technical critical problems, corporate level support, and in the networking group, so I had a lot of experience. One person knows I built a recording studio in my garage. I had a two-car garage. I like music. Turned it into a recording studio. It's probably something I only do once. Took about a year, pretty difficult. So here's some key takeaways. One thing I want you to know is how to get a capture, how to make sure you get all the data, all the traffic, and how to look through the capture, how to do filtering, navigate the UI, and learn how to narrow down your traffic for things you want to see. Also, I want to show you how to find interoperability problems with Network Monitor. There's, without reading the documentations, there's little tricks you can use in the UI, pick up some simple problems or simple validation issues that are sort of built into the parsers. And finally, I want to show you how to document issues, how you take a problem in Network Monitor and copy the information to text for documentation, for sending for a problem report. There's simple little ways to do this in the UI that's better than a screenshot. So let's go through a quick background to some history about Network Monitor. So how many people remember Network Monitor 2.0? Anybody ever used that in the past? All right, and those using 2.0, you use 3.0 now? Okay. So basically way back in the past, back in the 90s, we had a 1.0 release and a 2.0 release. And then what sort of happened here is I call it the Network Monitor Dark Ages. Nothing happened. The parsers weren't updated. Basically, they were dead code, and nothing really progressed. The product didn't progress at all. So circa 2006, we started working on the next version, a 3.0 version. We just completely restarted. So the UI is completely different. Some of the things you used to be able to do in 2.0, you can't do in 3, at least not the same way. So it's such a difference that if you're used to the old version, there's a lot of new things and a lot of new things to consider. So we had this new vision, a new team, and new design. It basically came up with a whole new UI, which I'm going to discuss here, among other things outside the UI, for that matter. So we had some certain goals. We wanted to make capturing easy, filter. We wanted to make the whole thing easy, safer, parsers, which I'll get into in detail at the end of the talk. We wanted to do performance. We wanted to make it automatable so you could put them in your scripts. And accurate parsing is a very important thing. We wanted our parsers to be accurate. We think that's probably the most important thing in a protocol analyzer, at least in terms of interoperability. So any questions before I get started into the meat here? Yes?
Is it already installed?
So Network Monitor is a free download. It's available on Microsoft Downloads. There's a blog, and all this information is at the end of the deck here, but there's a blog that has all the links for the free download. There's x86, x64, and IE64 versions of Network Monitor. So this is the Red Bus tour. I don't know if you've ever been to London before, but... Hello? Why don't I have power? There it goes. So there's this bus tour, and you drive around, they tell you about things, and you can get off the bus. So we're going to get off the bus every once in a while and do a demo. That's what I call getting off the bus here. But basically, this is the general stuff we're going to go over. And so we want to be able to capture network traffic. How do we get the trace to begin with? There's certain tips. Make sure you don't fall in some pitfalls. Discuss that, how you narrow down the traffic. Making frames easy to identify with, like color filters and using those to make traffic you want to see come out. Exploring a frame, how you take a frame and look through it. Working with fragmented data. There's a difference. If you're used to the way Wireshark deals with fragmentation, it's different in Network Monitor. We'll talk about that in a little detail. And then we'll talk a little bit about the parsers. I'm not going to go into too much detail, but the cool thing is they're included in the product. You can change them. It's just code, a simple script code that describes them. And there's some interesting things you can do with them, even if you're not going to develop a parser. And finally, we have an API. So you can write programs, experts. And one of the things we're going to talk about at the end is a decryption expert, which allows you to decrypt SSL traffic, which might be useful for troubleshooting and getting traces that is encrypted. So when you first start Network Monitor, it comes up to a start page. And if you double-click a capture, you're going to bypass this. You might never see this if you're the kind of person who goes into the Explorer and double-clicks a capture and it's, you know, associated with NEMA. So you might want to look at this every once in a while. The start page has some links, has a link to the blog, a link to the experts, information about new features, so it might be useful to see. Also has the most recently used capture, so if you, you know, have opened the capture before, convenient place to get to it. And then finally, it has a place where you can select which interfaces you want to capture on. You can change this later. It's just sort of like a default place where if you want to set up your default interfaces that you always use, this is the place you can do that. So when you start a new capture, on that page there's a link to start a capture. That's right here, you can say new capture from the button above. Brings up the interface to start a capture, and then you can simply just hit the start button, start capturing. And when you do, it will, this information will start getting filled in. So let me actually, okay, laser pointer. So the first section is as soon as you hit start, the frame summary will fill in. This is where all the frames get filled in. When you click on a frame, you'll see that the frame details then start to populate and the hex details. And then we also have this area on the side, which is, in fact, I've got them labeled. At the top is the display filter. That's where you would type in your filter. This is the conversation tree on this side. I'll talk about this in some detail, but it allows you to sort and organize traffic, or it does it for you automatically, and then explore that traffic in this tree view. Then, like I said, this is the frame summary. This is where all the frames collect when you start a trace, or when you open a trace, that's where they all appear. Frame details, and then the hex details. And the other thing I want you to notice is that there are in the UI, we have buttons that are sort of associated, and some people kind of miss these or don't realize that there's buttons associated with each window. And so auto scroll, you can find a frame based on a filter. So just keep in mind that there's these buttons there if you're looking for a feature and you don't know where to go. And so this is the dialogue I was talking about before, that you can select your interfaces on the start page, but you can also hit the button at the top, which brings up your capture settings. And on the capture settings, you can do a capture filter. So if you want to filter before you, while you're capturing and before you save the data, you can type in a capture filter here. And then you can also select your networks. So one thing that's different to differentiate between Wireshark and Netmon, one of the things that's different is you can capture on multiple interfaces at the same time. So if you have dual home, NIC, dual home machine with multiple interfaces, NICs, you can select two and have both traffic be, you know, in the same trace, which is helpful for, you know, if you have a, I don't know, ISIS or a firewall or something like that. The other thing is when you change a capture filter, which you can also do on the fly, we record that in the trace. So you can see when someone has applied a filter. So that's helpful if, well, just to see when it happens and to see that if you're seeing something missing, it could be due to a capture filter that's occurred before. So Network Monitor is not just a GUI thing. There's also a command line tool, and this is where some of the automation comes in. NMCAP is a tool that lets you do almost everything the UI can do. There are some exceptions, we'll see that in a second. But it's a scriptable command line interface. It has the highest performance. If you're having any sort of performance issues and you're dropping frames, NMCAP is the tool that's going to give you the best performance. There's no overhead of the UI. And we're going to talk about even more detail about how to deal with high traffic situations. The filtering is just like the UI. It's the same filtering language. You don't have to learn anything different. By the way, display filters, capture filters, all the filtering is the same. There's no different filtering depending upon what you're doing. You can also capture live, but you can capture from a file. So you can post-process a capture file and say you want to sort out all TCP port data. So, you know, you can take as input another capture file and output an output capture file. One thing that's different about Anycapture is you can chain capture files together. You have more options for capturing. So for instance, there's circular capturing, chain capturing, which is multiple files. The UI does not have this option. In fact, the UI just captures forever. If you start a capture, there is no circular, it just captures for all its life until it runs out of memory, which is one concern, which can happen, or at least eat up a lot of disk space. And then there's also a rich start-stop feature. You can stop at a certain time, you can start-stop based on a filter, so there's more flexibility. And then it's also automatically in the past. So as soon as you start Network Monitor, you can type Anycapture from any command line, from any command prompt, and you'll get the capturing. Yes?
Does this run on server core?
Yes, it runs on, so that's actually a good question. I don't have a slide for this, but it runs on Vista and above. So Vista, Windows, well actually, that's not true, 2003 and above. But on 2000 and XP, there's a built-in capture driver in the OS. So we don't actually install the hard driver's not compatible with the older one. So we use the built-in OS driver. And there's some restrictions in terms of this high-performance filtering, which I'm going to talk about in a second. And then on Vista, Windows 7, 2008, all the versions above that, you use the built-in driver, and it works on those as well.
On Core,
it only is
the CLI
module. Yes, and there's some special instructions when you install on Core, since you don't have a UI for the setup, you have to do a quiet install. And I think I have a blog on that. If not, there's a FAQ on how to do the install, like to extract the files and install them silently with the /Q command. Any other questions? So here's a little chart which I kind of contrast the features of one versus the other. And so this is the options I talk about, circular and cache, circular and chain, these types of options for specifying different capture file sizes. It's only in NMCAP. NMCAP gives you the highest performance, and it's automatable, flexible. You can use it in your script files, UI. You really can't. They both have application tracking, and so this is a feature that kind of goes along with the conversation tree. It allows you to filter based on a process and also capture all the process information. And this, until 3.4, our recent version, wasn't available in NMCAP, but now it is. And I'll talk about this feature in a little bit more detail as well. We also have something called wireless monitoring, which is a way of monitoring traffic, wireless traffic, before you connect. So you can actually sniff all the air traffic as long as you have a supported NIC, but that's only supported in the UI. UI has auto-scroll, there's really no, NMCAP doesn't show you the frame, so it doesn't make sense to have auto-scroll. And then the last three are shared by both. They both can do frame truncation, if you want only the first 50 bytes of a packet, they both can do that. Both multi-home, you can use them to capture multiple interfaces. And they both support the promiscuous mode flag, which allows you to capture traffic that's not destined for your computer. So this is the part of the talk when I want to discuss capturing in more detail. And so there's lots of scenarios here that you might run into while you're doing your capturing. And some of these things might help you get the traffic that you need to capture. So this is actually going into what promiscuous mode is for. And traffic has to arrive at the capturing machine. So our switches and smart hubs these days will often block traffic. So even if you have two machines plugged into the same switch, one machine might not see the other machine's traffic if it wasn't destined for this machine. So the traffic has to get there, first of all. You either have to configure your switch to mirror a port or something. NetMon can't do anything magic there. It's up to you to set up your network so that if there is traffic you want to see as a third party, for instance, between the server and a client, and you're a third party, you have to set up your network so the traffic arrives at that machine. It's very important. And then you need to enable promiscuous mode, which is not on by default, if you want to see that traffic. So there's two things you have to do. The other pitfall here is you want to avoid doing too much cache or filtering. So your inclination might be that, okay, I'm going to capture HTTP traffic. That's all I really want. I'll put an HTTP filter. A capture filter, and that's all I'm going to capture. Well, the way we parse our data is that a TCP fragment that's, an HTTP fragment over TCP doesn't actually go into the HTTP parser. Therefore, a filter of HTTP is not going to catch it. And that's just the way, when you type in HTTP, that means something gets parsed as HTTP. And so the way our parsers work is we say, hey, that's a fragment. Don't even try to show it as HTTP because it doesn't make any sense. It's not going to even parse properly. So putting a filter of HTTP is kind of confusing to some folks because you would expect to get all the port 80 traffic, but that's not what happens. So this is one of the cases where all this TCP information, all the fragment, might be needed if you're creating a filter. And if that's the case, it's safe. Usually, if you want to do a TCP port filter, that's usually safe. There's usually not much dependency below that layer. And same with IP address and MAC type filters. Yes?
Is it smart enough to identify HTTP traffic on non-standard ports?
So, yes, HTTP it is. There is a way. For instance, what we do is we detect the HTTP tag in a conversation, and we say, okay, if that one is HTTP, the rest of the port combination is also HTTP. So we do detect for HTTP, but there are other instances such as SQL traffic, which we don't automatically detect. And in those cases, you can modify the parsers with what we do is in TCP, we have a big switch, and it says port 80, case port 80, parses HTTP, right? So you can go in there and modify it. You can say, okay, I want to do port 8080, and again, for HTTP, it's done automatically for you, but for other protocols, you might need to modify the parsers. And I actually have the FAQ on that. That's a pretty common question. So if you need to do that, you just look at the blog, and it points to the FAQ, and you can find all that information there. All right? And so in general, if you can capture all, that might be the best thing to do. Don't do it, because it's sort of destructive when you do a capture filter. You're never going to get that data again, right? So capture everything as long as you can, as long as there's not any restrictions on the amount of data that's coming in, the traffic, the throughput on your network. Capture everything, and then just worry about it later. Just filter it later, and then you don't have to worry about losing anything. But there are situations where you can't filter everything. So this is the case where you're doing a capture on a really busy network, some server, and you start seeing in our display here, you'll see dropped frames. So I've kind of put arrows here. In the UI, it shows the dropped frames. And in MCAP, you have a running update that shows the number of dropped frames. So this is important to keep your eye on when you're doing a capture, because if you're on a really busy server, this number will go up. And if you start dropping frames, you might drop important ones, right? And you don't want to drop frames. The other thing you have to kind of keep your eye on is we have this thing called pending frames. So the way Network Monitor works today is we buffer the frames before we filter them, if there is a filter to be done. And so during that process, if the pending count continues to grow over time, that'll probably tell you, give you a clue in your head that, okay, sooner or later, I'm not going to, either I have to stop my capture and it has to catch up, or I'm going to get to a point where I've just filled up the disk or the buffer and I can capture no longer. So when you start a filter, look at your pending frames and make sure they don't continue to go up. And then look at your drop frames. As soon as you start dropping frames, you know there's probably something wrong, and you're going to need to address this issue. So some of the things that cause drop frames in Network Monitor, high-speed networks, 1 gig, 10 gig. These are the typical situations. Anything below that would seem to do all right capturing. But once you get to 1 gig speed, and there's some, I mean, obviously, low trickle track we can capture, but you know, once we get to a certain throughput, depending on your machine, how powerful it is, depending on the load on the machine, the disk load, there's lots of factors here, so it's not a simple calculation to figure out if you can capture or not. But you'll see drop frames. That's the indication that we can't keep up. And then two other things that kind of influence this is if you're using a capture filter, the more complex the filter, the more time it takes to evaluate for every frame. So as you can imagine, as we're going through each frame that's coming in order to filter it, we have to evaluate it. We have to parse it. And the more time it takes to parse due to a complex filter, the more chance that we're going to drop frames in the end because we just can't keep up with the incoming traffic. And then the other part, which isn't so obvious, is parser profile. So we have these parsers, and the parsers themselves will influence how long it takes to do a filter. And so some of this is the design or whatever, but in general, if you have a full parser set, we have many of them with the Network Monitor product. We have for instance, we have a Windows set, which parses everything. We have a default, which is a smaller set, and then we have a couple of other sets that are even more and more focused on the lower layers And using a more simple parser set will help you drop frames, fewer frames, and also keep up with the parsing. In fact, we have one called High Performance Parser Profile, which is just TCP, IPv4, IPv6, some of the, you know, just basically everything below TCP, not including ESP, by the way. And it is very fast. It'll be able to keep up with traffic much better than a complicated Windows parser set. So if you do find a problem, that is one of the ways to address it. And that's really what this next slide is about. So the high performance set is the fastest, and we have a command line parameter called use profile, and you can specify the parser profile you want to use. So if you're using a simple filter and you've got a high bandwidth network, use the high performance set, and then use a simple filter. More simple TCP port is more expensive than IPv4. IPv4 is more expensive than Ethernet, and so on. You know, so further, less it has to parse, the faster it's going to be. So we have another feature that we've added in the latest version called high-performance filtering. And so what we've done here is we short-circuited the buffering of the frames, and we tried to do the evaluation of the filter up front before we buffer it. So you can see that this will save disk load. You don't no longer have to buffer the disk anymore. And then as long as we can keep up processing these frames, we'll continue to bypass the buffer. There might be a situation where we detect that, okay, we're falling behind, and if we don't buffer frames, we're going to drop them. Then we switch for you automatically. And there's not a lot of, there's some things you can look at, the pending frame count is one of them, to understand when that's happening. But basically, if you get the pending frame count or the drop frames, that's your indication you're going to have to back off and do something different. So to use the high performance filters, and this works in the UI as well as at MCAP, is use a fully qualified path, we call it. So normally, if you're going to do Ethernet address, you type in Ethernet.address, and you don't have to put the frame. But if you put a fully qualified path, and it matches some specific fields, we didn't do a bunch here, but we did, you know, all the addresses, ports, all the common ones that you'd run into, then we will plummet as a high-performance filter. And it'll be done before the buffering. And hopefully, will allow you to keep up with the traffic. So there's also some parameters, some dials you can change as far as how big our initial capture buffer in the kernel space is. And I'm not going to talk through these. There's some complexity here, and hopefully you never have to go there. But if there is, we do have a blog on this, as well as a blog on this high-performance filtering, which you can find on the blog. You can search on it. And actually, that's probably the best way to get it. Maybe I'll add that on this slide as well, so we have both in the same place. So any questions on the high-performance filtering in general, capturing? No? Okay. So let's talk capsule file formats real quick. This is probably a common question, especially if you use Wireshark, TCP dump, or using a non-Windows machine, get a trace. We can open any PCAP version 2.1, or great, I'm doing a second bullet here, by the way. There is some fragmentation in the PCAP format, and 2.1 is not always the same, so there are some, we weren't able to find any specs on this. In fact, we talked to the Wireshark folks, and they basically told us, yeah, there's some versions that load it different. So if you try to load it in Netmon, it says it can't load it, and there's a problem, and you can load it in Wireshark, then what you can do there is in Wireshark, save it as a capture file. Wireshark actually, you know, has a little bit more experience, at least in the number of PCAP files they view, and they can save the capture file format that Netmon understands. But for the most part, we don't run into this issue too much. I just know it's out there, and have seen at least one issue where a PCAP did not load. Going to the first bullet, we actually changed our format. It's backwards compatible, or forwards compatible. You can load an old 2.x trace or a 3.3, 3.2, 3.1 trace, and a 3.4. But we've added some capabilities in the later version. So if you save a trace in 3.4, you can't open it downstream. It's still open Wireshark, by the way, that we didn't break that at all. We actually fixed some things in the file format. And then one of the things we added was the ability to support time zones. So this is the scenario where you get a trace from China, they send it to you in Seattle, and then you're looking at a log from China as well, like an event log. So you might know, when you look at an event log, it actually does the time zone changing for you, and it doesn't match the time when it was actually changed. It matches your, it does the calculation to adjust it for your time zone. So we can do the same thing with the trace. We can also, if you open a 3-4 trace, the way it worked before is that if you took a trace in China, say it was 9 o'clock, and you look at it here, it's gonna say 9 o'clock. It's always gonna be 9 o'clock wherever you look at it. That was the old way it was done. And sometimes that's useful too, because maybe you have a text log that doesn't adjust the time zone, and that's what you wanna kind of match it up to. You open up the 3-4 trace, it's gonna automatically show the new time zone information. But there's a drop down in the UI, which I'll show you in a second, that allows you to switch back to the old 3.3 format and see the old version. So you get both with the new version. So before we go on too much further, let me just show you the UI. So let's go to the start page, and we'll just do a new capture so everyone's on the same page. It's a new capture, start, and as soon as I hit start, frames start coming in. So some of the other things I'll show you while I'm here that I really don't talk about when I talk too much. You can see that we actually have different layouts. If you don't like the one layout, you can switch. This is the diagnostic. You can do the simple one. If you change your layout, which you can move the windows around, you can overwrite these built-in ones, and you can revert to them later if you don't like what you've done. But you can customize this the way you want. So really quickly showing you the time zone. So these are column layouts, and so we have five of them. Three of them are kind of built-in ones to handle certain situations. So the default is I'm doing a new capture, this time, this new 3-4 format, but I can switch to the 3-3, and so if you keep your eye on time, date, local adjusted, which means it's adjusting for the time zone, I can show that in the old method. Now it's not gonna change because we're not moving anywhere, but now it's time of day and it's 12:28. So if I were to go look at this trace in another time zone, it would still say 12:28 on this screen, but if I changed over to another one, the time zone would actually adjust to that. And there's other column layouts. You can do TCP troubleshooter, which kind of shows some common TCP frames, and since I'm on a wireless network, it's mostly wireless data coming through, which I could filter out. Yes. Oops. So I'm gonna apply a filter. I'm gonna hit Control Enter, which is a shortcut for applying a filter. People use Wireshark, use Enter, Control Enter. Now you can see the column layout has some specific columns. Again, you can modify these. If you wanna do an SMB version, you can modify them and save them over the TCP. It doesn't rename it, it still says TCP, but you can go ahead and customize these like you however you want. Stop this, and we'll go back and look some more things with the UI. Actually, I can show you real quick what I was showing you before. So as soon as I click on a frame, it populates the frame details, text details. I click in the frame details. You'll see that it highlights the value in the hex details. Another cool trick is in the hex details, I can double click anywhere, and it'll find in frame details the matching text. So this is cool if you see something over here that you want to know what it is, a name. It'll actually sync back to the frame details if you double click the hex details. Okay, so now next we're going to go kind of more into some of the stuff we just talked about, but diving into the details and figuring out how to find information, important stuff. So we're going to talk about the conversation tree, which I kind of spoke of quickly at the beginning, the introduction. Show you how to do filtering, how to learn how the filtering language works. Pretty straightforward, it's similar to Wireshark, at least in the syntax. But we do some cool things for discovery. Show you friendly names called aliasing. We're going to dig into the details, talk about reassembly. And then we'll talk about annotating captures, which is a cool feature and something that we have available on Coplex system documents. And we'll talk about those that use this annotation feature to show you how traffic works. And then we'll show you how to find protocol documentation references using the parsers and a little trick here that we've added. So these are some of the things that we've talked about already, but this is exploring a frame, and these are the top two I've already just done in that demo there. in fact, the top three. Some other things is you can code as, so if something's not parsing properly and you want to force it to parse as a protocol, we also have structures in our language, but if you want to force it to parse as something, you can say the code as in hex details, you can highlight the code, highlight what you want to parse, and then hit the code as. You got to watch out for fragmented data, and we have some slides on this, so I won't talk about it too much. The next bullet is one of the points, one of the key points I talked about as far as documenting data. So you can basically copy anything in the UI as ASCII to the clipboard. And so this is useful. This is, so I get a lot of people that show me like screenshots of stuff, and then I'm like, okay, well, I want to go over here where you didn't screenshot, and now I can't see. I'd rather have an ASCII representation of it. So I think this is more useful for most things. And so the last bullet is kind of the same thing. So let's just demo this real quick. I think it's easier to show than it is to explain. Okay, so the first thing is let's talk about, I've got a bunch of frames here, and I want to copy these in text. Well, you highlight them, you copy them, I'll do Control C. And now, if I open up something like Excel, what we do is we actually format the stuff with tab separated. So when you paste it into Excel, it pastes it like you expected. It does all the columns, it breaks out the columns. So this is a very easy way to kind of take the information. If I want to get rid of some columns, I can do that as well. So it's a very simple way to kind of get that text in text format. It also can do, you know, paste it in the notepad. And, it's tab separated, so it doesn't show up quite as nicely. Some other tricks is like when I'm doing an email, I'll paste it into email, I'll copy the whole thing, and I'll say insert table, and then that automatically formats it. And then I can get rid of columns. One thing it doesn't do, which is something that we hopefully will add in the future, is it doesn't put the column names at the top, which would be kind of useful if you've added columns. Yes?
Does it add the payload of the packet?
No, it's just whatever your columns are in the UI. So you could potentially add a column that shows the payload, except that our UI is dependent upon ASCII. So if it has some funny characters in there, it won't display properly. But you can actually add a payload column for TCP, for instance. We have something called a property, and you can add that as a column. So if it was all text, you could do that. Yes?
Copy-pasting your frame details as well?
Yes. In fact, that's the next thing I'm going to show you. And you can do hex details as well. You have a question?
Side question. It was just that way you got the exploit view of all the three.
So it shows the view as you have it set. So if you needed to explode the whole thing, you could right-click and expand the whole thing if you wanted to. But usually what I do is I expand the stuff I want, and then when you copy here, I'll right-click this time, copy tree, because copy will actually just copy one field, copy tree will copy the whole tree, and then when I paste that into a message, it shows the display. So again, a lot more useful than a picture because it doesn't cut it off. And then same thing in hex details. Now, what's interesting about the hex details is the way we format it. And there were two choices. We chose one of them. There are reasons to have both. But you'll see that we put the hex first and then the ASCII later, and rather than doing the column layout. The reason we did this actually is because if you need to copy something from the ASCII, it's really difficult if it's all broken up. So this is actually easier if you need to copy some of the data out of the ASCII. But there's reasons to do it both ways, obviously. And then you can do the same thing in the conversation tree as well, actually. So it's available everywhere. Any other questions on that? All right, so that is about exploring the current frame. So next thing we want to talk about are conversations. So what are conversations? Basically a logical grouping of frames. It's a visual way to kind of zero in on some data based on these conversations. And so for instance, I see Explorer up here, and I want to look at all the traffic that Explorer sent. I can click on that node. The way the conversation tree works is when you click on a node in the conversation, it filters the traffic for you automatically. One thing to keep in mind is that a display filter also will be done at the same time. So it kind of does them both. It does a capture filter, and based on what you, you know, ANDs it with whatever you have selected in the conversation tree. And sometimes you get confused, right? You kind of click on Explore, and then you say, oh, let me try Display Filter, and there's no common traffic between the two. You don't see anything. So now you have to go back to the conversation tree, go back to the node, select the root of the node, and then you see all the traffic. It's also hierarchical, so that means that for every process, there's IP conversations between two machines that are sorted underneath it. And then for each IP conversation, there's TCP conversations below it as well. And so this goes all the way down the line. And these conversations are defined by our parsers. That means that our parser writers, and anybody who wants to modify them, can define whatever a conversation is. So that means that it does not even have to be a stateful protocol. It could be based on any key that's the same across multiple packets. And that's all really a conversation is defined by our parsers. And we just happen to define them in logical ways so that you can get IP conversations between two machines or a set of ports and other things. Another thing that conversations do is they provide state. Now, this used to be more of a problem when conversations weren't enabled by default, but they are now. But if you turn them off for some reason, maybe there's some overhead with conversations. It has to kind of collect information. It saves the state. Maybe you turn it off to do something. Well, there are certain parsers that rely on the state in order to parse correctly. There's certain information, such as RPC. If you do an RPC bind, that bind is only in the first frame. And somehow it's got to be remembered throughout the whole trace so that anytime you see another TCP port, another conversation at the TCP level, that is part of that same RPC. So if you turn conversations off, that state information is lost, and you'll no longer see RPC information parsed properly. So for the most part, you want to keep it on, but if there's some memory issue and you're only troubleshooting TCP, you could turn it off. And again, so it's required by some parsers, and it's defined by the parser, something as part of the parser. Any questions? Yes.
Yeah, your example there. How come TCP is showing up both as weak and a node in the conversation?
Okay, so that's a good question. So in this case, IPv4 has, in this example, has a TCP conversation, and ESP in this case is writing on IPv4. So due to the hierarchical nature, IPv4 is the parent, and it can have writing on top of it TCP, or it could have ESP, which in turn could have TCP tunneled within the ESP frame. So this is just actually showing you, interestingly enough, the relationship between the protocols. And in this case, it's just two different protocols from IPv4 layer. Does that make sense? Any other questions? So here are some tricks, some ways that I use the conversation tree. This might be helpful. So again, selecting conversation filters on that conversation. I'm going to demo these at the end. You can right-click a frame and find a conversation. So this is, if you're a Wireshark user and you want to follow the stream, this is one half of that functionality where you can right-click any frame, say find TCP conversation. It'll highlight it in the conversation tree, and then you'll see all that data dealing with that stream. You can scan children. So I'm going to show this. This is basically allowing you to kind of look at all the information based on the conversation tree that's probably related, at least related to the same nodes that you're clicking on. You can display. Remember, the display filter is combined with the selected conversation. You can right-click and copy a conversation. So say you wanted to do two conversations, you can right-click, paste it as a display filter, do the second one, display filter, and now you can get traffic that shows both of them. There's no way to select two nodes in the conversation tree, which would be the way you do it via UI if that was possible. And then we've had requests before to be able to filter on the conversation tree, which you can't do. But as a virtual way to do this, you could click on the conversation, save that information, and then when you open it up, you'll see that the conversation tree has been scoped down to whatever traffic you had before. So that's kind of maybe a workaround. So let's just do these real quick. So when I was talking about, let's do this first. So we have this conversation. I'll put back on my regular columns. And I'm looking through the traffic. And as you notice, I already have it filtered out. So I'm going to go to the top of the tree, and now you see all the traffic. If I'm looking through here and I see this SMB conversation, I can right-click on it and do Find Conversations. And what you'll see is TCP, but you'll see all the conversations you can focus on. So you don't necessarily have to follow just the TCP stream. You can follow the IPv6 if you wanted to see all the conversations between those two machines at the IPv6 level. So I'll go ahead and select TCP. You'll see that now it's highlighted the node over on the left side of the conversation. And now only the traffic for that conversation shows up. So now you see a nice clean trace of that single conversation and rather all these threads running through the trace. So the next thing I might want to do is I'll do this thing I call scanning using the conversation tree. And so now that I've found this, maybe I'm interested in all the TCP conversations. And I can now just click and it'll filter. And now I can down arrow. And I can kind of really quickly see what other things are going on at this level. I think it's a very powerful way to kind of get a quick overview of what's happening on this machine without having to do multiple filters. So I'm just kind of scanning the conversation tree. Like I said, I can copy. I can click a node and say copy it to the clipboard. And then I can paste it. And it actually creates a text-based filter. Expand this a little bit. Based on the conversation that I selected. And it's really, you can go analyze it. Basically, it's the filter that gets that traffic only. And I could pour two of them together if I wanted to, you know, put two up there. And I'll just show you this real quick so it can show you how it can be confusing, but not that I want to. But so, for instance, I've selected this traffic, and now I say, oh, I want to see HTTP. Well, it's not going to show me any data, because remember, it's combining the two. And the one tip here that this is happening is we have, in the frame summary, we show you that a conversation filter is selected, along with the currently applied filter. You know that I could pipe in here, I could say, for TCP or something like that. Well, I haven't applied it yet, so that's why this is not changed yet. So it can be different. Kind of gives you some visual clue what's happening. And so to see the HTTP traffic, I would have to click off the conversation tree. And again, it's this that's being applied, and now I see all the HTTP traffic. Okay, any questions on conversations? Yes?
How do you bind the tracing of the conversation with the process? Does it on port number?
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. So how does it work? How does it work in the background? So the way we do this is while we're collecting the trace information, we're constantly scanning the TCP table. There's some APIs, probably seen them before, that say, give me the list of all the processes and the related port tuples. And so we just constantly scan this table and then update when we see a match. Now, this brings up a good point, is that we can actually miss a conversation. It's not perfect. The processes, if they go really quick, if they're fleeting, we won't be able to see, capture them in the table. So there are some chances that that can happen. There's some parameters to modify those, actually. For the most part, there's not. I haven't seen a big problem with this, but it is possible.
So if it's a long-lived TCP connection, you won't have a problem.
Yeah, and that's for the most part what it is. But you do every case you see it say unknown, and it just didn't capture it for whatever reason. So another important thing is that this process information is only captured by NetMon. You can't take a Wireshark capture and load it into NetMon because that information is not going to be there. And conversely, Wireshark doesn't know what to do with it, so it doesn't show anything. It's in the capture file, but they don't know how to parse it yet. Any other questions?
Is there potential price conditions where the process you're shooting is using that TCP port?
I mean, I suppose it's possible that I think, well, I don't know exactly how the OS assigns the ports, but I suppose if it uses the same ID and happened to use the same port, then yeah, you could have potential where one process came up, went away, but we recorded it, and then a different process used the same process ID. I think actually the way the OS does process IDs, it doesn't often really uses them, so I think it's pretty rare that that's going to happen, but that would be possible. Any other questions? Okay, so filtering. So this is conversations, one level of filtering. It's actually, I think, pretty easy to use and can become a very powerful tool, but there's also the regular filtering that you'd expect in a protocol analyzer. So I want to reiterate this again. All our filtering is the same, exactly the same. display filters, capture filters, MCAT, color, binds, they're all the same filters. You only know one filter in Linux. We have something called standard filters, and this is what I'm showing over here. This is a great way to learn about our filtering and also to have some canned filters. And we have a bunch of them filtering under addresses like IPv4 or IPv6, HTTP type filters. Another really good one to know is this search frame filter. So I'm going to point this one out specifically. This allows you to search the binary information in the frame anywhere with a filter. So for instance, if you know the text, a phone number appears in somewhere in the trace and you don't know where it is, you could use this to find it and find the frame that matches. And it's just either an ASCII text, Unicode, or actually hex values. And I'll show you a demonstration of this real quick because I think it's very important. Now, we also update our CodePlex parsers almost monthly, somewhere around that time frame. And we also update, among other things, our standard filters. We update our color filters as well. So you might find that new standard filters have been updated. So this is one good reason to keep up with our parser updates. Though having the latest parsers is probably more important. We have IntelliSense for building filters. So if you've ever used IntelliSense or the autocomplete feature in Visual Studio, you type dot and it kind of gives you some choices based on those dots. We'll show that example real quick. And also in our help file, which is available in the help menu, there's some examples as well. So three different resources, or at least two different resources for learning filtering language are the standard filters and the help file. So here's some clever tricks. So IntelliSense will work if you just start with a dot. If you start with a dot, it'll show you all the high-level items that you can filter on. So this is a good way to start, and you'll see that there's a bunch of them here. Protocol is probably the most common one. You want to learn the next, TCP or whatever the protocol name is. But there are other ones there that are based on how we define our language. And property might be another one that you're interested in. Color filters are trippy. We have color filters that allow you to define a filter define a color, a background and foreground color for the summary frame based on a filter. Same filtering language. I'll show an example of that. You can also right-click and add a filter. In the frame's details window, if you see something that you want to find something like that, you see a TCP port, for instance, you can right-click on the port and add it as a filter. It'll build the filter for you. This is actually another great way to learn how to do filtering if you don't know anything, where to start. And it works with columns in the frame summary too. You have a column you want to filter on. You can right-click the column, not the column header, but the column, it's, the column information. And then you can build a filter based on that. And then finally, there's Control S. So this is different than executing a filter. This is just finding the next frame that matches a filter. So maybe you have a bunch of data and you don't want to filter and then unfilter. You just want to find the next frame where a file is set to test. Well, you have Control F or find. There's a find button as well in the UI. So here's some examples just to kind of give you an idea what it looks like. If you actually type in the name of the protocol, it'll filter those out. So MSRP or LDAP will find all those frames where it's been parsed as that. TCP.port=80, that hopefully makes sense. It's a simple filter. You can filter on these things we call properties. Now, properties are just metadata that we define while building the parsers. One of the downsides of properties is we also use them for like local variables and state information. So there's a lot of properties. What we tend to do is preface the property name with the protocol. So if you want to look up an SMB property, type SMB. Now the reason these are important is because they provide a way to get the data that doesn't have the same path. For instance, a file name in SMB might appear in 10 different locations with different filtering paths. So what we've done is said, well, that seems like a pretty common thing to filter on. Why don't we just call a property called SMB file name that you can look for that property that appears in any frame, regardless of where it appears. Properties are also important because those are the things you can add as columns. If you have a property, it can be added as a column. Data field cannot be added as a column today. So some filters based on properties is, say you wanted to filter on the process name. You want to find everything that had the process name of iExplorer.
You should drop the arm.
I'm just going to say that. I just realized that myself. And then if you're just doing, for instance, you can filter on the protocol, which is the column that appears, if you want to filter on the text. And maybe this isn't this useful because the same filter LDAP will find that data. But perhaps you want to find, you know, all protocols that had LDAP in them or something like that. And so color filter is an example. You can find all the TCP retransmits in orange. Again, the retransmit is a property. It's some state information that we keep track of for each frame. We keep track of the sequence numbers, and we find, you know, a resend. We actually mark this property for that frame. And so this property allows you to find all retransmits, and you can also create a color filter. And then show parser error. So this is kind of going to the to one of the key elements, is finding problems with your protocol according to the documentation without reading the documentation at all. And so we have this thing called parser error is one example where we flag, we'll actually create a structure when we detect something wrong with the parser. Now, we don't do a lot of validation here. We're not checking every single field, validating every field. But there's certain instances. For instance, if we don't parse the whole frame, if there's some extra data sitting at the end, our parser didn't work. Something was wrong. Or the implementation didn't implement the protocol properly, and there's some extra data on the Y. Well, this is a very simple way to find all those frames. So if you suspect there's some protocol issue, or you just want to check to make sure your protocol, as far as the parser is concerned, don't display any problems, you can just do a filter, a parser error, or create a color filter to show those errors and make them pop out. Okay, we have some things we call their plugins or whatever, and this probably makes sense if anyone's done any program, but we have this thing called contains. And contains allows you to search within a string, right? So if you have a, in this instance, we're looking for a URI, you know, a HTTP address that contains Microsoft somewhere in the text. Cool thing about contains is that it works on ASCII or Unicode data, and it's not case sensitive. So it doesn't, you don't have to worry about the format of this string in the text. If it's Unicode structs, we'll find it. If it's, you know, case insensitive, we'll find it. But we also have another one called contains bin, and this stands for binary. And the reason we added this is that contains has a limitation that if the data itself is not all ASCII, it gets confused and stops. So, I mean, this is kind of like if there's a zero, a null at the end of a string, but there's more data following it, contains stops. It's just like a regular, you know, search, string search. So what we did is we added a new one called contains bin, which does a more low-level search. It basically searches a whole blob of data for a string, for a Unicode string, or a hex string. Now, this is a little bit different. You have to tell it what you're looking for. You have to tell it you're looking for an ASCII string, or tell it you're looking for a hex string, and it's case sensitive. It will honor the case. So there's a little bit of differences. We actually use this to do the search frame. So let's go actually do that right now. Oops.
And you can use wildcards, right?
No. So there's no regular expression. For contains, I mean, usually what you do is just do a little snippet. Yeah, so regular expressions is one of the features people have been asking for. We don't have any sort of regular expression support. So let's actually show the standard filter, since that's where I talked about. So we do load filter, and we do search frame. And so we actually add in some comments, which you can add into your filters if you want to sort of explain how to use this particular contained bin. I would say 99% of the time, you use frame data as the first parameter. That means you want to search the whole frame. I don't see many reasons to search inside a payload. There's actually some issues sometimes. So I recommend always use frame data. Second parameter is what you're searching for. We have these constants defined to give names to them, ASCII, UTF, BE, so you have Big Indian, Little Indian. People get...
Sorry.
Yeah?
No, UTF-8
score. No. So if... no, there's no UTF-8. You can search ASCII, but not UTF-8. So there is a limitation there. But there's a workaround. And that's the hex. So if you know the hex of the data you're looking for, you can just type in the hex string. So, and this question has come up a couple of times. People are like, UTF-2 16, I don't know, what is that? I don't think it's, well, I put, so we put this little thing in here, looking for Unicode, UTS-16 BE is probably what you want. That's the usually the common Unicode, but there might be differences based on your platform. Any other questions? So if I apply this filter and I'll look for something different. Maybe I want the MS, oops. I don't know if I, what's in this trace to tell you the truth? Probably look for the letter E. So now I've found all the frames, and I'm sure if I click on a frame here, letter E will appear somewhere down here. And so the other common one is hex, and I think this is maybe more useful. And by the way, this hex, ASCII, these are just constants defined. It's actually 0, 1, 2, 3, just defined as constants. So if you're doing a hex search, what you do is you just type in the text like that. In fact, let me put a something different that I noticed there. Maybe that's a better example. So now it starts. It actually doesn't tell you where it is in this frame, which is a little bit, would be more helpful. We actually have an expert, and I'll talk about experts in a little bit more detail, but it's an expert called Simple Search, which does a little bit better, does regular expressions, by the way, so we have a workaround for that as an expert. But it runs as a separate executable, and will highlight in another window where it finds it. So it's a little bit more, fills in the gap of some of the things that our UI does not do yet. So let's show IntelliSense real quick. So like I said, you hit dot, you get the top level. Protocol, dot, and now I can say T, it shows me the T, it's TCP, and so that's how I get the TCP. Now you don't have to start there. If you know it starts with TCP, by all means, type in TCP dot, and then you'll see all the TCP elements. So if you want to look at flags, and then I can look for everything that happens in. And so the IntelliSense makes it easy to find these things.
We would start with protocol anyway, just so you have the performance filter, right?
What's that?
So we would start with protocol anyway, just to have the performance filter?
Yeah, if you're going to start, frame is actually where you start. So frame is just a protocol, it's kind of like our main. In C, is kind of that's where we start our parsers. We look for a protocol called frame, and everything starts from there. So you have to start with frame dot, and when you do that, you'll see all the protocols at the frame level. Ethernet's one of them. IPv4. So that would be a fully qualified. So if this is a display filter, it has to be a capture filter to do a high performance capture filter. If I did this in a capture filter setting. Yeah, that would be applied as a high performance filter. So then the other way I showed you, which is maybe I'm going to remove my filter, and let's just say I'm scanning through the traffic, and I see something interesting. What's that? And I want to filter on it in the text itself. So let me switch to this. So I'm looking through the frame and I say, okay, well here's a TCP frame, and there's the source port. I want to filter on the source port, so I can right mouse click and add values display filter, and it builds the filter for me automatically using the port that I look for. So if I apply this filter, it's going to find all source ports equal to that. Now, you might say to yourself, well that's not really what I want. I want both source and destination. I want it to go both ways. Well, in that case, we have some special properties and it's just port in this case, probably port. But the fact of the matter is, for certain protocols like TCP addresses, IP addresses, Ethernet addresses, you have this special property that allows you to do it in both directions rather than from the source or from the destination. And those show up in the IntelliSense, so you can find them. Yeah?
Can you figure it so it does the decimal port number?
You can. So, it automatically adds the hex when you right click, so you can't change that.
Okay,
but you can put anything up here. So
well, yeah, up there. But,
yeah, and so another maybe a good example here is you can do, 192.168.101, but you could also put the hex or the decimal value up there. We don't really care.
But it always does hex from there.
So even if I pick
even the ID address.
Yeah.
Because I'm not typing hex there.
Yeah, and so usually when you're using this, you just want to find things that are like it. You don't really care what it is. So if I do that, yes, it's going to show the hex value.
Okay.
And so you'd be like, all right, I don't know what that is, but maybe you don't care. You just want to find other frames like it. And I agree, you probably should put it in the native format that you expect. But this is one of the, you know, this is where we are right now as far as this particular feature.
Okay.
And in some cases, for strings, it does put strings up there. There is some calculations or some conversions we do for certain areas. And so I'll show you one real quick. Is that if I right-click on a description, you see that I can search on the description. I clicked on a column in the UI, and now I can search on the description. And this is kind of cool, because now I can say, all right, well, maybe I don't want the description, but maybe I want something in it. So I use my contains macro. So now that I know that that's what the name of it is, it would be probably expected to be called description. And now I can search for anything that says TLS. And now it'll search this description column, the actual formatted data, for anything that has TLS. So you can look for error, for instance, or some error code that you expect to be in the description. Now it has to show up in the description in this column, but that's one thing you can do. You can also do it on, this as well. And so what you might notice is that it did a string here. And that's because all our properties are either strings or longs, or big numbers. And so this is a little bit different than our tcp.source filter, because we're actually looking for the string here. Now, Netmon does this thing where it'll look for resolution traffic and sometimes substitute the friendly name that it finds in the source column. So you might see, Paul's machine show up there. Well, now you can do a filter on that as well, but it has to be resolved in the trace. And then finally, we have something else called aliases, which I'm going to show, but it's a way of renaming these addresses so they become friendly and easier to use. Okay, any questions on filtering? Yeah? If the IP address is resolved by DNS traffic, it'll show the DNS-friendly name. Yes. So any sort of DNS resolution or NetBIOS name resolution, those will be done for you automatically and captured for you. And the way to turn it off, actually, is so the columns, like I said, are properties. And sometimes you don't want to see all the resolved things. You want to see the actual IP address. Well, the columns itself is a special property that says, okay, if there's an alias, use it. If there's no alias, look for a resolved name. If there's no resolved name, show the raw name. If you want to see the raw name all the time, then you have to add a column that shows always the raw name for whatever you're looking for, because it could be IPv4 raw name, be IPv6. So now the column, you can have multiple columns depending upon what you're looking for, and the source kind of aggregates those for you automatically. Maybe that's not always what you want. So aliases was the next thing I was going to mention. You can give friendly names. You can right-click on the name itself and say create alias for source. And this works for the destination and source column. So for instance, if you have a trace, often what I do is I go through and I try to find out what each of these things are. I say, oh, look, that looks like an exchange server. I'll give an alias of exchange. And then it'll automatically use those names in the source and destination column only. And it kind of makes it easier for me to understand what the traffic is doing, just giving these friendly names. Yes.
Is that for a trace, or can you make it that global?
So you can make a global, and so you make a global that loads every time. So for instance, the scenario might be, you have this group of machines, it's always the same, you want to use the same alias all the time. So you can create a default alias file, and then you can also save off alias files if you want to send it to somebody, or you had a set, for different setups, you can load in alias files. And it only works in the columns. Like in the frame details, it doesn't actually show the friendly name there. Though you could modify the parts that have done that, and I've actually done that before for a customer. Okay, any questions up at this point? So let's talk about reassembly. So I'm going to contrast the difference between reassembly and Wireshark and them. I'm just going to give you an idea if you have some background. If not, we'll talk about the details, the way Network Monitor does it. So in Wireshark, it automatically, you load up a trace, and it just reassembles for you at the TCP level. And it might do it at other levels too. I'm not sure exactly what reassembles and what does in Wireshark. They have some reassembly built in. So what they do is they actually take the TCP stream and they replace the last frame in the stream with the reassembled data. Well, they don't replace it. They show both, but you don't actually see the original last packet. And then they make it look like the first packet. So if you're going to look at the trace unreassembled in Netmon, for instance, then the first frame is going to show the description and then all the fragments. The Wireshark, all the fragments and then the description. So if you're trying to compare the two, you might get confused. You might not, you know, you have to understand how it's working to, in order to compare the traces. So protocol, a protocol can fragment data at many layers. TCP, HTTP, XMP, all these things can do their own fragmentation. And so we don't automatically reassemble, but we have a button that you hit to reassemble the trace. And what it does is there's logic, again, built into the parsers that explain how to reassemble a protocol. And we use that logic to insert new frames. So I'm going to show you this because, actually, I think I have some slides that display how this works. But the trick here is that there's new frames inserted. All the original frames are there, but we insert new frames where the fragments are. And we do it at each layer. So you'll see if you have fragmentation at TCP and HTTP, you'll see the TCP frame, TCP fragments put together. And then you'll see all of those combined and a new HTTP layer frame inserted. So you kind of might get confused. You might say, OK, well, now I see all the original ones and then all the fragments. But there is a way to get around that. I'm going to show you that. Only available in a saved trace. It's kind of important. If you do a new capture, the button's not going to be there. You have to save the trace, open it up, and do it again. And again, it opens up the new windows and inserts frames. So one of the keys, if you don't know anything about reassembly, and you see the word continuation, all right, that's the light bulb to go off that says, all right, this thing's fragmented. I need to see that payload data, which might not always be necessary, but there are certain protocols which the header will span multiple frames. TCP continuation, there might be other HTTP continuation frames, is a clue that you need to reassemble the data. And so you hit the reassembly button. A new window pops up. And now all the original frames are there. But like I mentioned, this underlined frame is a newly inserted frame that has an interesting frame details. And as you'll notice, it doesn't have the TCP layer below it because we've now reassembled all that data. TCP data, frankly, doesn't really make a lot of sense because we could fix up all the sequence numbers and stuff like that, but that doesn't really make a lot of sense. So we put something called a payload header on all our reassembled data, and then we put the reassembled frame above that. So what's kind of cool about this is I can use this fact that it has a payload header create a color filter, which is what I've done, underline those frames so that they pop out more easily. So any questions on that? There is one more trick that I don't have a slide for. So a new thing we've added, so I say we update our parsers monthly. So one of the things we've actually added is a way to find these reassembled frames with a filter. So you can imagine that if you looked at only the ones that had payload header, if you did a filter on just payload header, you're only going to see those frames that have been fragmented to begin with. But it's, you know, obviously not everything has to be fragmented. There'd be some things that fit in a single frame, and therefore you're going to miss all of those if you try to filter out just on payload header. So what you really want is all the frames that are not fragmented anymore. And so what we've done is actually built in a property that we set when this is true. And so, I wish I had an example, and maybe I'll have an example I can post later. But what I can do now is I can say, property.http. And then I want to do, forgotten the name, so I'm looking. Complete. Actually, I'll tell you, we'll do TCP. I'll tell you what, I'm not going to search for it now, but there's a property that you set that allows you to search for only those full frames, and when you do that filter, it'll show you just the unfragmented frame. So it kind of gives you a complete looking trace without all the fragments in it. And so you can do this at certain layers. We've kind of programmed this for TCP, for HTTP, and for NBT, which does SMB fragmentation. So for any of those protocols, using this particular filter will help you when you looked at a reassembly frame. And I have a blog on this, by the way, so if you search the blog, you'll also find this information. Okay, any questions on reassembly? Yes?
Do you see the hex detail for the assembled packet?
What's that?
Hex details on the line, do you see that?
Can you see that on a reassembled frame? Yes. So it's just like any other frame.
Only one set of IP headers there?
There's no, so what we actually do is when we create, because there is some state information such as the IP address and the TCP port information, so when we create this payload header, we pass some properties through that we know will be needed in order to correlate that data with the other. So since there is no IP frame or TCP frame, there are some, you still want to associate it with that traffic. So if you do a filter based on a conversation, for instance, if you click on the conversation tree, you want to show that frame. So what we did is we pass in the properties that we know are important, and those properties exist and are re-instantiated when the frame is parsed. So what happens is there's a property called TCP source port, I think is what it's called. And so that property then builds the conversation. So that means, so this is actually a good point, is that if you do a filter of TCP.port equal and the port for this fragmented data, that fragmented data is not going to show up because there is no TCP header on top of it. So what you have to do is augment it with this property to find those frames that match. Now the easier way to do it is just use a conversation tree, because that works. The conversation tree is built on these properties for you automatically. So if you go find conversation, it's going to find all the right data. It's just if you manually type in a port filter, you might miss some of those fragments.
And what happens when you save it back?
Okay, so you can save, so you can save a reassembled trace, and it'll have all the reassembled information in it.
And size becomes double or something like that?
What's that?
File size grows?
Yes, the file size will grow based on all the frames that you've inserted. But that's kind of cool. Now you don't have to reassemble it, right? You can open up the trace and it's done. It doesn't have to reassemble it again.
Can it be open with the Wireshark?
It can, except they don't understand the payload header yet. We've actually filed some bugs with them, so they know about these problems, but they haven't really gotten around to changing it yet. Okay, frame commenting. So this is the idea that you have a trace, and you want to add some annotation to it to tell other people what's going on in the trace. And so what you can do is you can select a frame, and add an annotation for that frame. So what happens, is that when you do that, we put this little hash mark, little number sign next to the frame number that indicates a comment has been attached to that frame. And then once you save the trace, you have to save it to a new file, you can pass it on to somebody else and they can find these things. So the next question might be, okay, well, I got a trace, how do I find what's been commented? These comments are also just properties. They're actually just properties that are instantiated with each of these frames. So you could actually do a filter and say, all right, I want to find all frames that have a comment title in them. Or I could search for certain text in the comment title if I want. The other cool thing here is that the description here is RTF, so you can actually, we have some keystrokes that allow you to do some formatting. I find it easier if you just go into write or something that supports RTF formatting. Do the formatting in there with the cool UI and then paste it back in here. And it'll reserve all those comments. So for instance, if I saw a frame here and I said, okay, well I want to create a frame comment. By the way, in this particular view, these two things will collapse on top of each other. So that I edit, and I can add in, this is a broken frame. And what I could do, actually, is why don't I copy the tree, and I could copy that tree in here, but I can even do something better. Oops. I could bring in the write, and let's say for some reason this was the interesting data. I could highlight it. Then I could copy it, and then I could put it back into the frame comments. So it keeps that format. So it's kind of cool if you wanted to do some annotation, tell some of your buddies something's wrong, make something stick out. The other cool thing I can do is that since the column title and actually the description is also a property, I could add this as a column. So we haven't talked about adding columns yet, but I can go ahead into the column dialog chooser. I can say comment title's name. I can add it. And now this frame, which I will now use a filter to find it, or actually I can, let's do this instead. I can say next comment. Oh, maybe I didn't save it. Oh, so this is a reassembled capture. That's why it's goofing on me. You'd have to save it first and then be able to add a comment. So there, it added the little number sign to it. I'll go ahead and add the column because I added it to the reassembled view, not the one I was working on. And so now you can use this, and you can have the comment titles, little annotations on what's going on in a trace. Now, you can't add the description as a column. The description is too long. It has all this RTF formatting that we don't draw properly up here, so you can't do that. But you can do title. You can filter on these titles. I actually have a blog where one of the features people wanted to do is highlight a bunch of frames and make them all blue or something, and so they can kind of go back and hit Control F1 to highlight them and Control F1 to undo them. What I did is I just used this feature and a tool that does some Windows manipulation, you know, send keys basically, and I programmed a way to do this. So I have a blog on that as well, but there's a script and a separate tool allows you know to hit F1 to colorize frames and toggle them on and off. So there's kind of some cool features you could do beyond what the UI supports by using this comment type.
Can you filter on just say if it has a comment or not?
Yes. So just back. But that was the other way I was going to use to find this frame, because you can keep on doing next, but then you can do comment. It's frame variable, it's not a property actually, so it's wrong. But you can say, you know, not equal to that. Okay. Find all the frames that have a comment.
One other interesting thing is some of our system documents, I don't know if anybody's seen system documents for Windows, but they're in our technical documentation set, some of them have accompanying commented traces.
Yeah.
Where we've commented traces to
explain. Yeah, so that's actually the next slide I was going to talk about. So we have the system document and the traces on CodePlex. And so, for instance, we have a lot of these AD, Active Directory, we have three of them. In fact, I could bring one up, so let's do that. And so these are traces that some of our folks have commented, using this particular feature, to describe the traffic based on the documentation. And so this is kind of a cool way to learn a certain flow of the documents using these comments. And so now you can see that when I open the frame documents, it says overview, it shows you the section of the documentation that it's talking about. It has links to the various documentation. Now you can go next comment to see what the next line. So it creates a user via SMR figure 9 step 1, kind of describes, it's kind of paralleling what the document is for describing this behavior. So this is kind of a really cool way to learn how the documents work in certain scenarios. And if there's like feedback you guys have as far as maybe other scenarios you want to see, you can send them to us. I know we always get feedback. I don't know if kind of bandwidth we have for creating these, but there might be certain situations you've run into more often, like detail. And of course, you guys, it's a CodePlex project. If you guys have something that you've formatted you want to share, might be something that we could accept into the project and also post it up there potentially. And there's a bunch of them other than AD, and I kind of cut off the page there. But that's the location, search for sysdoc or system documents. You should be able to find it over there. So this is just a really quick slide on the parsers. I'm not going to go into any detail about the parsers, except that they're this special concise language that we developed to describe the protocol. They're all shipped in the product. They're all there. You can explore them. We actually have this GUI, simple GUI editor allows you to change them and recompile and then see your changes. We've had some folks out there that created protocols internally for themselves using this. And we also update our parsers on CodePlex. So what we kind of hope is that someday somebody has a protocol that they want to donate or add to the CodePlex, and we could add as another parser available to the community. So if for some reason you guys get a wild hair and write a parser, maybe it's something you guys can contribute. So we update them about monthly, so you should go up there and check. Pretty easy to install. Again, they include color filters, other standard filters, some other things. And you can write your own parsers or customize the existing one. So I talked about this case where maybe you want a column that doesn't exist. Well, you could modify it potentially and add your own property that could be displayed as a column. You can change summary lines. Maybe the summary line isn't really working for you and you want to change the way the summary is displayed to put some more pertinent information up front or something that's not there. And we also want feedback sometimes. I mean, sometimes we write a protocol, but we're not the expert in that domain. And you guys might say, it would be more useful to me if you always included the file name on this particular call. Send us an input, put a bug on CodePlex, and we can modify the parsers. And we turn around these changes pretty quick. And since it is an open source project, you could get the new file the day after it's fixed. There's no installer. We do that monthly. You could actually get the updated change pretty quickly. It specifies how the data is reassembled. If for some reason your protocol isn't reassembled, you want to add that logic, you could. And then, as I mentioned before, it defines what constitutes a conversation. And maybe there's some reason for you to want to create a conversation based on some state, and you can do that as well. So here's another little piece that kind of goes to the finding the documentation. What you can do with the UI is you can also look at our source code. So for instance, let me find something kind of interesting. So I could actually search this code, search where the code is by right-clicking on the data field and say, go to data field definition. And what it does is it pops open the window, the code, and puts highlights the frame in the code where that thing is defined. So if you need to explore something, you need to figure out some of this stuff, that's one way to explore it. But another thing it does for you is, let's say that you're looking for the documentation on some protocol and you don't know what it's called. What we do is at the top of the parser file, we describe the references, the public references and the Microsoft references. So you can use this as a way, if you see some traffic and you don't know where it came from, you can use this as a way to kind of narrow down where that comes from. So it kind of gives you at least some sort of link back to the documentation. And moving forward, this is something that we think we can do cool things with. So I think this is an area where we can improve and make it even easier. So that's really all I'm going to talk about as far as the parser go. But if you want more information, all the documentation has the parser language, describe the help file. And we have examples on CodePlex as well on how to write a parser, a small little kind of walkthrough. This is the parser tab. And by the way, if you hit the reload parser button, it rebuilds the parsers, reloads them, and if you have errors, they'll show them down here, which you can double click and try to figure out what your errors are. There's also an explorer, an object view on this side, which allows you to search through the objects and jump to the code based on this object viewer tree. Okay, so finally the API and the experts. So probably the cool thing from your point of view is the experts, at least from a general point of view, is the experts are these tools that use the API to help you do some cool things. And I'll talk about more of that in a second. But from another standpoint, you can create programs to help you test your protocols using the API. Maybe you want to parse something and validate that it matches something. And so the API kind of gives you some cool abilities. It's all included. When you install the UI, you get all the, at least the library and the .h and everything you need to build. You just need like Visual Studio or some development environment. We have a DLL that's included. This is non-distributable. So if you want to create a program and distribute it, the requirement is that the user has Network Monitor installed. We don't want you copying the DLL out there, and then us running into a situation where we release a new one, and now that old one's out there. We're trying to avoid the old problem with DLL mismatches that have happened in the past. But what you can do is, if you need a solution for this, is you could chain our install during your install NetMon while you're doing the expert that you want to install, or the program, or whatever it is. And so what can you do? You can read and write capture files. If you just want to parse through a capture file or create one, the API will let you do that. Capture live data. Maybe you just want to automate a tool to capture live data in a service or something as part of your test run. You can also filter live capture data, so you can create a filter, a capture filter. We also have other, so I talked about the high performance filtering in the API. We actually have some special API that even let you do lower level filtering. You can inspect data fields, so you can, you know, parse the data like the UI does. You can read properties, read the comments, and get display descriptions, so you can show the description exactly like the UI does. In fact, you can probably duplicate a lot of the UI using the API. And you can access conversation information as well. So one of the cool outcomes of the API is something called experts. And an expert is just a general tool to help solve a domain problem. So the typical example here is something called top users, and you've probably seen this before, but basically gives you an analysis of a trace based on the top talkers in a trace. So if you want to see who's eating up all the bandwidth on your network, you can run this expert. Basically, there's an expert menu now. You can select the traffic you want. You can actually say, you know, you want to look at this conversation. The expert can then take that information once you run it and then show you analysis. So in the case of top users, you can take the whole trace, run it through, and it'll give you a grid and also a graphical a pie chart or whatever of the data in the trace. And these experts just use the API, though they don't have to. And a special thing we've added in the UI to pass information to the expert. So what we do is we call your expert and we give it a command line. We give it the file name, the capture file, maybe the filter that was currently applied, the conversation that was currently selected, and you're able to create a program that takes that data, parses it, and does something. Now, it's not attached to the UI. There's no communication. It's not like a DCOM or a COM object or anything like that. It's a separate executable, these experts are. But there's a world of possibilities, and there's lots of domain-specific stuff that I imagine people doing to solve domain-specific issues or help troubleshoot problems. So I think there's a lot of potential there. And they're available on CodePlus. So when you go to the expert menu, you can actually hit the download experts, and that brings you to the web page of all the current experts. And these things are things that we are updating over time, and we still keep them up to date. So the one I wanted to show you is Enum Decrypt Expert. So the situation is you get a trace, and it's decrypted, and you want to see that payload data, but you can't. Well, we actually have a tool, this Enum Decrypt Expert, which allows you to, as long as you have private key, you need the private key to do the decryption, so you have to somehow have to be able to get that data. And so what we do is we give you instructions. As long as you have access, you export the cert, the cert file, and then you can import it into the expert and it can decrypt the data. And then it works similarly to the reassembly expert. It opens up a new version of Network Monitor with the decrypted data. So let's show this real quick. So the first thing to understand about encrypted or traffic in general and the expert is that what the expert does is that you give it the data you want to run through the expert, and the expert tries to decrypt it. Now, if you give it a whole trace that had 20 different HTTP conversations and potentially multiple keys, the expert's going to get confused because you told it that this was the valid cert, but it really wasn't. So you want to narrow down your trace before you run the expert. So you have to have some knowledge beforehand to make sure you're looking at the right traffic. And another thing before I get started, this expert is also an open source project. It's something we're actually probably very close to right now, making it available. It's available as open source right now, but what we want to do is get a lot of community involvement. So there's a piece of this that needs improvement. There's no reason why, you know, us as a community can't, you know, improve it. And so if there's something you want done, we can get you involved in the project and improve it, make it better. Because a lot of these things are limitations based on the code, not necessarily on real things. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to search for TLS traffic. I just want to find, I know there's some TLS traffic in here. I'm going to right click on the frame and just kind of go look. And now, so I see a bunch of TCP traffic. And I see that each of these are complete, I'm going to remove my filter, by the way, are complete conversations. And so what I can do is select one and run the expert. And the expert gets this conversation information passed to it and knows to only operate on that particular piece of, not part of the traffic. So now I'm going to run the expert from the menu. And so what's happening now is that it loads another tool, another executable, and so this is the code that pops up, and it comes up with the capture file. That's another piece of information that's passed. And so now I'm going to browse for the certificate. By default, it looks in the same directory where the capture file is. So there's the PFX file that I've exported. The certificate password, this is something you have to know. Someone has to tell you, or it's part of the certificate. And then you give an output capture. So I'm going to say, let's use this one again. Let's replace it. Now you can optionally add a default log file. So if something goes wrong, you can send this to me, probably, and I can figure out what's going on. So I'll go ahead and create one. So now I'm going to start. So now the expert is processing the data. It's going through this particular, looking for this traffic, applying the cert on it, and decrypting the data. So what's going to happen in a couple of minutes is it's going to open up a new file with all the original data plus newly inserted frames for the decrypted data. I'm going to show you that. So, and this actually takes a while. So in the meantime, I think I wanted to show you the documentation for all these experts, also included, so you'll see that there's one expert. There's also how do I use this expert. And so this has the information on what it can do. There's certain limitations on certain decryption algorithms that it can't decrypt, so that information's on here, what it can do. It also has the details of some common troubleshooting issues. One of them is that when you create an HTTP or an SSL conversation, there's two ways of doing it. One, or there's two negotiations that happen. The first time you negotiate, you say, all right, here's all the information you need to decrypt the data. It's got the entire session set up in it. And then it returns this session ID that can be used in future communications. Well, in those future communications, if you look at one of those sessions and try to decrypt it, it doesn't have all the information it needs to decrypt it. So you can get an error stating that like the session object ID is reused, which means that it's tried to reuse a session object, therefore I don't have all the information I need in order to decrypt it. So you need, so in some cases you have to restart IE or maybe restart your program so that those keys are negotiated and captured in your trace. So also in the help, it has the steps on how to export the certificate. So these are also in the help file if you need to, you know, learn those steps and how to export that key. So now the new trace is open. And as I mentioned, it has, better make sure. Okay, here's the new trace. So now you can see that the conversation has been limited to the one key that I've looked for. And in this case, I've actually created a color filter, something to make this pop out, to tell me what those keys were. And just like in the reassembly case, we add a new header. We add something called the decrypted payload header. And this was something we decided to make up that we could probably reuse for other encryption issues. But this gives you a simple way to find all these. So I'm going to do protocol. Yeah, so there's a bug in the API. So this could be fixed. This is one of these things that I haven't had time to fix. The community could go and fix. But there's a problem with our API. When you write a frame, it doesn't honor the timestamp properly. And so there's a workaround where you could just go afterwards and update the table in the capture file. It's something that we just didn't get to fix before we released. But it is something you could work around. So I'm going to apply this filter. And now I'll see just those frames that have this payload header. And so now what you'll see is rather than this encrypted data, you'll see the actual unencrypted data. In this case, it's HTTP. And it shows up just like regular HTTP traffic. And in this case, it's all been, you don't have to worry about the case where it's reassembled and part of the frames are a fragment or not. Everything's been encrypted. So to find the unencrypted data, this particular filter will show you that data, and now you can go on. So some other limitations with the filter. So I mentioned that it can't work when you have a session, just the session object. In other words, you've done a negotiation, you've got this token, and now you're trying to reuse the token rather than doing the full negotiation. It can't deal with that. Well, lots of times what happens is a program or Internet Explorer will do the connection, shut it down, reuse this object over and over again. And that's actually what's happened in this trace. So what will happen if we look at the traffic, because this is a very common problem, what you'll notice is in the client hello, there is an object, session ID length that says it should be 0 if we've never negotiated before, but it's 32 if it's passing along this reused object. And so this doesn't work with the expert today. You can't decode that. Good news is that I know how to fix this, and I think this is something that will probably be one of the first updates with the expert and the next thing that we post out there. But it's something that can be fixed, and then by fixing that means I could actually highlight the whole conversation, the IPv4 conversation, and it'll just go through and parse all that, decrypt all the data, even though it's reusing the session. So the requirements are is that the original hello has to be there, or it negotiates, and then long as all the rest of the conversation is just reusing that same session, the decryption will work. There's another caveat. Yes?
Will this work for ephemeral?
For what?
For ephemeral
1500. So there are some that are supported, some that aren't, and for some reason I think that's one of the ones that aren't, but the documentation has the list. I can't remember the name, but there's the, not synchronous. There's two different types of general encryption, and there's one that's dual, I can't remember the name. It's look in the help file to see if it's supported. It might not be. And I don't know, for some reason, so Wireshark has the same limitation, so I'm not sure if it's a limitation of encryption. I don't know how it works enough to understand the limitation. So the other caveat I was going to mention real quick here is that in some cases, the traffic itself is intermixed. If you look at this TCP conversation, and this one, the frames are kind of intermixed. They're not totally separated. And this confuses the expert. Another thing that we could fix if we really wanted to. But there's a workaround. What you can do is save each of these frames in order into a new trace so that they're just stacked on top of each other. And I'll show you really quick. I'm doing this. But there's a feature in Network Monitor that's useful for other things called the Frame Buffer Manager. And what I can do is build a new trace by selecting them and then piecemealing parts of them together. So this is a solution for this. Again, this is probably something pretty simple to fix in the expert. Well, I'd say probably that wouldn't be that much, but there's probably some way to make this a little bit more automated, or automate this anyway. But that is a limitation, and it's just a workaround to do that. So keep that in mind if you're using this expert. Okay, any other questions on API, experts? I think I'm pretty much done. Any questions? Yes.
Large Sharp has a lot of security issues with their enforcement.
That's an awesome question.
MPL, I suppose that'd be compiled, but it's not, does that have the same issues?
Exactly. So that's one of the things when I brought up the goals is safety, and that's one of the things we wanted to do was get rid of DLLs. I mean, this is the problem with Wireshark and other tools is that they install their parsers of DLL or code, and you're running this on a system, right? You're running on a server somewhere, probably to capture some data, and there are lots of security problems with Wireshark. I met the guy, Brett Cones, he said that's what he does all the time. He just runs down these fires of people reporting security issues with Wireshark, and I'm not sure a lot of administrators know this, but that it is a security problem. So with our parsers, we've sandboxed that information, and that's what keeps you safe. As long as you can write whatever code, and maybe it'll freeze netmon, but it's not going to freeze the server, and it's not going to have these issues with DLLs that we do. That's an awesome question. Yes?
So did I see earlier on that you were decrypting the ESP traffic?
No. So, yes. So this is probably traced from Microsoft. Microsoft used null encryption, so we don't actually encrypt our ESP traffic. So we will show that traffic. And I know Wireshark has this option to turn it on or whatever, but it's not. We can't decrypt the ESP traffic. And that's one of the other things in the future that we understand is probably becoming more and more a problem.
That's what you said last time.
What's that?
Last time you said that.
Yeah, I'll probably say for the next couple.
Said, yeah, that's in the next version.
Yeah, well, not. Yeah, we haven't done another version since 3.4. But yeah, that's something we're looking at. We understand it's a big problem. And I'll probably repeat it again and again until we do solve it.
Okay.
Any other questions?
It's the API stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that's completely headless code. We can write just like a service that uses that DLL if we want.
Yes,
but we can't redistribute it. We have to.
We can't redistribute the DLL. So
can we redistribute the netmon install?
No, because. The
you
same
can
reason.
You can chain the netmon install.
You can chain the install. So the install is on downloads, and so there's like a URL. So we've had people solve this problem. It's a little bit messy, I agree. And it's something we want to understand.
It's very attractive to use that rather than having to write all the Windows filtering platform, kernel.
Right. I think for the chain install, we've had some people solve the problem like that. So we know it's doable. But you do have to have internet access. That's the one, point is probably if the computer that's doing the install doesn't have the internet access, then it can't chain our install. So they have to somehow get, and they could do it manually. I agree it's not the most ideal situation, but the alternate is that we update our product, and then all these people running the experts are going to have a mismatched DLL, and then they're going to have all these weird problems, and they're going to call us, and we'll be like, oh, we don't, It's an extra headache. There's a balancing act there, obviously, between supportability versus ease of install or whatever. So the parting things, I want you to download, install, play with Network Monitor 3.4. It's a free download, like I said. Visit Codeplex for the latest parsers. When you install, it has a version of the parser that's part of the package, and so you have to update the Codeplex parser to get the latest parsers, and there's some dependencies, even with the encryption experts, that require the latest parsers. And then think about experts for your domain or projects like that. If you have an idea, you can contact me. Maybe we can think about creating an open source project for that, or at least just help you with that particular problem. And that's it. And here are the resources in the slide. I'm pretty sure you guys have access to this. The blog is a great resource. Everything's kind of available and pointed from the blog. The blog's kind of like a central place. We have links to videos, to all the resources, the downloads, facts, everything from the blog. If you have forums, if you have questions, Netmon, parsers, API, the forums. And of course, the links to the experts and the code website. Yes.
Do we get these presentations?
I don't. Daryl.
Yes.
Stop. Okay.
Yes, we post all the Plugfest presentation content as recordings. Number one on channel 9, so those will be available following the Plugfest. The ones from the